Hello and welcome to On Sacred Ground on the LMC Radio Network on Blog Talk Radio, broadcasting the voices of the land and of the dead by weaving together history, ethnography, and spiritual experience. I'm your host, Kai Armand, and if you're tuning in online and having technical issues, remember that you can listen to the show by calling in via your phone or Skype to 657-383-0525. That's 657-383-0525. This is our 18th episode of On Sacred Ground, broadcasting at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific, on May 30th, 2015. On this episode, we have special guest Courtney Weber, High Priestess of the Novices of the Old Ways Progressive Witchcraft Coven here in New York City, co-creator of Tarot of the Burrows, and author of the new book, Brigid, History, Myth, and Magic of the Celtic Goddess. And you can find more about Courtney at her website, thecocowitch.com. That's the thecocowitch.com. As this is a pre-recorded show, we will not be taking any callers, but do hope that you enjoy this episode. And we will be beginning, as we always do, with a poem from the book Earth Prayers from Around the World, 365 Prayers, Poems, and Invocations for Honoring the Earth. And this one comes to us from the Congregation of Abraxas, and it reads, Ancient Sun, eternally young, giver of life and source of energy, in coal and oil, in plant and wind and tide, in spiritual light and human embrace. You kindle the heavens. You shine within us. For we are suns with hearts afire. We light the world as you light the sky, and find clouds within whose shadows are dark. We give thanks for your rays. And without much further ado, I invite Courtney Weber to join me. Courtney, are you there?
I'm here.
Awesome. I'm so glad that you are here. So this book on Brigid is phenomenal. It is filled with so much heart. I don't know if, I mean, yes, this is a popular goddess. Many things have been written about her from, you know, in many different fields. I don't know if a book has ever been written on her with so much heart, though.
Oh, thank you. That's very, very kind of you to say.
So maybe you can just start off, you know, our listeners who may have never heard of the goddess Brigid or just heard of her, you know, sort of in a cursory way. Who is she?
Well, Brigid is, it comes from the Celtic world, from Ireland, but also from England, Scotland, even deeper into mainland Europe. And she has been around for possibly as far back as the Stone Age in different forms. And she's most commonly known in our contemporary vernacular as a goddess of the wells, a goddess of fire, a goddess of innovation, of healing, of childbirth, and parenthood, and also a patroness of animals. She really comes from the idea of the living earth as a cognizant being. She embodies everything that the ancient Celts and even their contemporary people of the Celtic world really found to be important. I think that she has really taken root here in the United States because she embodies a sense of homeland. And the people I've talked to in Canada, often in some in Australia, it really reflects a similar experience of many of us are displaced from the homeland of our ancestors, whether they were removed from the homeland and moved to a reservation, or they were brought over here on ships in the Middle Passage, enslaved, or whether they were immigrants and fleeing poverty and coming to these worlds. There is a deep sense of disconnect from the motherland. And Brigid seems to provide a sense of homeland for those who are displaced. I know a lot of people that have worked with Bridget primarily for her sense of healing, whether it's because they're trying to heal connections with their ancestors or because they themselves deal with chronic conditions or substance abuse or other sorts of issues, emotional pain, other things that really need the help of the divine to connect the place that is broken. And I have told people that she's also one of the most accessible goddesses who exists. I very rarely have known people who feel they really can't connect to her in some form, even if these people don't identify as Irish or Celtic, that they still are able to find something about her that makes sense. And I think it's because she's a goddess that really embodies the spirit of hope for a better world tomorrow by implementing the tools we have at our fingertips today. So that's a very broad broad way of introducing her. And I also forgot to mention she's also a goddess of warrior women in particular.
Well, you know, that might be a bit broad, but I actually just, what you said, hope for a better tomorrow by implementing the tools that we have today is so powerful. And when you say that, I think of obviously, you know, like the word hearth and the home, but also I think of community and I think of sustainability efforts. I think of, you know, as you said before, this idea of the land and her being, you know, sort of the bounty of the earth for a group of people. And here we are today where, you know, we've definitely, our sense of our idea of progress, our idea of, you know, what technology can do for us has definitely led us astray from some of the things that are the greatest meaning, like, are we going to eat tomorrow? Does everyone have enough to eat? Does everyone have enough to eat? Does everyone have clothes on their back? Is everyone feeling comfortable? Is everyone feeling whole? I feel like you're sort of speaking to a spirit who these kinds of ideas are really important to her, and that her arrival in the United States, or at least maybe her recent, you know, repopularization, is really timely.
I absolutely agree. I think, yeah, she does embody the spirit of the woman who's opened her front door, or man, or whomever this is, that opened their front door and said, please come in, have some tea, have a cup of soup, warm up by the fire, because you have greater work that you have to do when you're going out. I actually wrote about this recently for a blog for Patheos, which is about the hearth and home goddesses and how they are connected to the warrior goddesses. And I feel like in modern paganism, there tends to be a disconnect in that individuals may be honoring gods or goddesses of innovation and warfare, or they honor the gods of the hearth and home. And it's as though you have to pick one or the other, that if you're going after the gods that are out there fighting battles, you don't focus on the home, and vice versa. Those who are working more with the hearth and home goddesses, there can be a sense of, I don't do the work out there in the world, I just work from the home. But the home is where the people are fueled so they can go back out and fight the battles that need to be fought. And if you don't have someone feeding the warriors are going to burn out and the cause is not going to be won. Likewise, if people are just sitting around the home, eventually the scary things that we're trying to fight are going to end up at your doorstep. So there is a sense in which they people have to find the balance between the two, which is why in my research I was surprised to discover that Bridget had so many warrior aspects when so often she was considered that figure of opening the door, come in and have a seat and have a cup of soup. But when I was really thinking about it and seeing how important the relationship is between the house and home and the warrior gods, it made perfect sense that she would be a goddess that existed in both realms.
Well, that's so powerful, you know, and important, obviously. We have this, you know, the need for restoration to be able to do what we are going to do in out in the world, and then we need to come home, this yin-yang balance. What led you to Bridget? Is she a spirit that you knew from early in your childhood? Was there some great revelation or epiphany? What happened that you would devote so much time to writing a book about her?
Well, for me, it was really a series of doors that opened one after another. And when I first started discovering witchcraft, I didn't really know that there were all these gods and goddesses of witchcraft. I think I thought more that there was, it was just a different way of worshiping the same Judeo-Christian God that I once knew as a child, except perhaps with a female face. So I really didn't understand the concept of polytheism. But I started circling with a group of witches in my hometown of Portland, Oregon, and one of them said, I want to anoint you with Bridget oil, and she explained that she had been a goddess and had been transformed into a saint when Christianity started to make its way through Western Europe. And it didn't really click with me as to who that was. And she anointed my forehead. And very strange thing, I said, I feel like my eyes are green. And my eyes are blue. But I turned and looked in the mirror, my eyes had turned green. And I wasn't drinking that night. It was a sober circle. There was no tricks of the light or anything like that. But my eyes had turned a very deep shade of green. I said, okay, well, there's something going on here. I don't really know what it is. And I don't really remember the next part of the story, but a few months later, I suppose, I was working really hard on a short story for my fiction writing class. And I was falling in love with writing in a way that I had not fallen in love with theater. And theater had been my major in school, and I was about to graduate college and realized what I wanted to do was write. But I was stuck. There was a story in me, but I could not get it out. And so on a whim, I lit a candle to Bridget, and I asked for her help and promised that I would write a book for her if she would help me with this story. And in my mind, I thought I was probably going to write a bunch of poems saying how much that I appreciated her and praised her and leave it on my altar, and that was going to be it. The short story came out, I talk about this in the book, that it came out rapid fire and was published and was nominated for awards, and but then after that, absolutely nothing was working for me in the writing world. I tried to write the book to Bridget. I think I got like two or three pages in of some pretty bad poetry and then just said, you know what, I failed at this and I'm really sorry. And I turned away from her for a long time. And it wasn't until years later through readings that people said, you know, you worked with this goddess and she'd like you to start working with her again. I'd forgotten all about my promise. And I started discovering more about her. I traveled to Ireland for the first time. I started attending more Imhoff circles, Imhoff being the February holiday, which is in honor of Bridget, and in really making her the guiding light of my faith, and consulting her before I do tarot readings, praying to her at night, consulting her in the morning, doing trance work, and really exploring who she was and all of those pieces. In time, I felt like something was missing, and so a lot of things were not going well in my personal life or in my creative life. My professional life was pretty much stalled to a job that kept me fed and kept me housed, but wasn't fulfilling me personally and really wasn't doing a lot for my financial goods either. And it was at this time that in different circles, when the spirit of Bridget would come through, the great message that kept coming to me through these seers is, where is my book? And I thought that somebody had already written some powerful book about Bridget connecting the old gods to the Christian church, and there was one secret book, and it was probably locked in the libraries of the Vatican, and it was going to be up to me to go and find it and get it out and give it to the world. And I was ready to move to Rome. It was completely nuts. And then one day, she came in through again during a very powerful ritual, and it finally clicked when the seer said, why do you think I've messed up so many parts of your life? You didn't keep your promise to me, and I will not let your life move forward until you keep your promise. And something in that moment, I remembered that I had made that promise in my little tiny college apartment many, many years ago and had forgotten about it completely. So a few weeks later, I sat down and started researching to try to figure this out. And part of the journey to writing this book was as much fascination and curiosity for my own journey as it was trying to keep this promise to get this goddess off my back so that she would stop ruining my love life and my professional life, creative life, so I could actually go on and do some other things besides blog on MySpace. So it was a very messy process. You know, I was telling people that nailing a cube of Jell-O to the wall is kind of like what it is trying to find the identity of an Irish goddess, because it moves around a lot and you don't really, it depends on who you ask who she is, and the stories contradict each other, yet they're all considered valid. So it was a very arduous process. And I don't know. I mean, there were times in my life that I wondered if I really should have explored some other gods before really committing my path and journey with this particular one. However, sometimes you just get it right the first time, and this is one of the few times in my life that I did get it right the first time. I'm usually someone who has to screw something up about, you know, 9 or 10 times before I figure out how to do it right, but this was, you know, somehow my path landed me in the right place on the first try.
That's. I mean, having participated in rituals that you've led with novices of the old ways, I can't, you know, obviously from an outsider point of view, I can't imagine your life without Bridget being so integral to your life. So this idea of, you know, I wonder if I could have spent, you know, time working with other gods. I'm thinking, like, who? Like, you know, Bridget's your homegirl. Like, we all know. it's like totes obs to the rest of us. But from the inner, obviously, for your inner life, it's not, you know, just totes obs. It's obvious, you know, for you, it's a journey. It's a journey that you were willing to go on and that you were beckoned on, and we're all benefiting from that. Now, you've said that you've been to Ireland, but I know that you've also led some tours in Ireland as well.
I did. Yes, I've been to Ireland, I think it's 5 times now, maybe 4 times, I'm trying to remember. And twice I've led groups of people over there. You know, Ireland is such a... I mean, to say it's remarkable is really a weak word. It's the kind of country, it's soaked in the land that you can't wear your facades, you can't carry your ego, because she sees right through you. And I say she, I mean the actual earth of Ireland itself. And it can be really a crazy experience for Americans to go to Ireland and suddenly feel the land strip away all of the facades that they put up to who they're supposed to be. The things that they have to prove, because Ireland doesn't care if you're trying to prove something or not. She's going to knock it out of your hands, right? Knock that mask off your face right away, and you're left with nothing but your bare soul on the damp earth and in the damp air, and really feeling what it means to be a human being in this beautiful, beautiful world of ours. And we've talked about how human beings have disconnected themselves so very much from the earth, but Ireland is one of the places that won't let you forget that you are a creature of the planet. You're an animal, and that's all you are. You're not superior to any of the other creatures on this planet. And I know that's not the only place in the world where those things happen, but it's a place that I've experienced it, and I've seen it happen. It is a transformation, and I feel like when people leave Ireland, they appreciate the sense of the world, the wonder within the world. That's very easy to forget sometimes when we're running around behind our masks and we can't fully breathe in deeply the planet that we live on.
How would you say that Bridget is seen in modern day Ireland?
You know, it's really interesting. She very much has a Catholic face in Ireland, because Catholicism is still very, very strong, but more and more the revitalization of the indigenous religion is growing stronger and stronger all the time in Ireland, and re-embracing the Beltane fires and the great Samhain rites, and you know, the community and the kind of dancing and celebration that was so integral to Irish culture for so long before the Catholic Church suppressed it all. In some ways, it's almost like she is as natural to the culture as breathing. St. Bridget is, I would say that she is more ingrained in culture and practice than even St. Patrick. Now, St. Patrick is the one everyone talks about being the patron saint of Ireland, but it's Bridget's rites that are really so woven into the culture and folklore and practices over there, whether it's blessing the home or blessing the fields or praying for children, praying for healing. She has healing wells all over the place, and they're so well tended and so well frequented. It doesn't seem as though people are really all that concerned as to whether she's a goddess or a saint. She is just Bridget, and that's all there is to it. So you can call her what you will. She's still the same person in a matter of faith. And I experienced that also in England as well. And now she doesn't have as much of a footing in the overall culture of England as she does, say, in Ireland, but the places where we found these ancient, my companion and I found these ancient English Celtic cathedrals. You know, St. Bridget had that same sort of natural place in the overall faith, and there was not a real question as to, you know, who she was. Yeah, she was one time a goddess, or sure, she's a saint. It doesn't matter, she's still Bridget. And she adapts wherever she goes. When I was in this little town called Chelvey, England, with my friend Gemma, and there was an 1,100-year-old Norman cathedral dedicated to St. Bridget. And when I walked inside, the church warden's wife was giving us a tour of the place, and there were altar cloths with wheat sewn into them, images of the wheat crop. And that was interesting to me because everywhere I'd gone in Ireland, Bridget had been connected to water and to oak and to farm animals that gave milk. But I had not seen her having anything to do with wheat. And I asked the church warden's wife what that was about. And she said, well, you know, Bridget is a patron saint of bread. And I said that was news to me, and I wanted to know more about it, and told her that in Ireland she'd been the patron saint of cheese and milk. And she said, well, it's really the finished product. She said, we're wheat farmers here in Chelvey, so she's going to be the patron saint of wheat to us. So that told me so much more about her just in that little conversation than in the hundreds of books that I could have combed through to find something out. But it was much more important than, is it milk or is it wheat? Is it cheese or is it bread? It's about taking something raw and making it into something that will nourish the people.
Yeah, that's totally, adaptability that was relating directly to the people that she's interfacing with. I can totally see how, as a researcher, that was one of the most profound moments for you as you were exploring her. Is there a human life or a human life story behind this goddess saint that you either ascribe to or that's, you know, sort of your favorite story or favorite understanding of her?
Well, there was a historical, pseudo-historical character named Bridget who was a bishop, actually, in Kildare, Ireland, I think around the 10th century. Forgive me, history nuts out there, if I'm getting the timing wrong. But the thing is that the term Bridget was much more of a title than it was an actual person's name. It really meant the great lady. So while, yes, there was a goddess aspect that was Bridget of the wells, Bridget of the fields, what it was really saying was, this is the great lady, the great spirit of the wells, the great spirit of the cows. And so when women in that time period in Ireland held a position of power, she would be called Bridget. Not because she was necessarily named that, but that would be what her title was. So there was a woman who they believed was a druidess, a priestess in the druid caste back in the day, and she was given the rites as a bishop, quote unquote, by accident. That when they were supposed to consecrate her to be an abbess, they actually made her a bishop instead. And that was a role that even today is unheard of for women to have. But in the conversion of the pagan faith to Celtic Christianity, it was really important to have the Druids and the Druidesses on the side of the church. And if they had not given that Brigid the kind of power ascribed to the men, she might not have been as helpful in converting the great shrines and then converting the people to the new faith. So it was really strategic. And so then this Brigid was able to preserve the great shrine in Kildare, which was the perpetual flame been burning for hundreds, if not thousands, of years. And instead of it being extinguished and demolished, it was then turned into a Catholic shrine, pretty much kept intact in the way it was beforehand. And that fire continued to burn up until the Reformation, when it was extinguished again for having too much pagan influence in it. But then reignited actually in the 90s. There is the perpetual flame in Kildare has been restored. So I like that aspect of her. It's a sense of, she could have fought to keep her role, and there are some who say that maybe she should have. We don't really know what the circumstances were. If it meant that there would have been war in the land and possibly her own loss of life or loss of life of the other priestesses to not convert, then she may have made a very selfless decision to do that. Whereas, holding on to it could have meant so much more destruction, yet she was still able to preserve her integrity even while she had her ego and her position challenged. So that's one of the stories that I really like about the historical Brigid. The more mythos-based Brigid is a very wily character. And she's one that was known to be very, very sweet and kind and loving and generous with all who came to see her, unless you crossed her sisters. Then hell hath no fury like Brigid's horn. Oh, my God, she would go after you. And one of my favorite stories was when she asked the Bishop of Kildare for some land, and he says that she could build her abbey, and the bishop said no. And she said, well, how about I just have a little piece of land? And the bishop said, no. And she said, how about I just have a piece of land that my cloak will cover? And the bishop said, okay, that's fine. I'll give you the land that your cloak can cover. So she and her sisters got together and they started to unfold her cloak. And the cloak continued to unfold and unfold and unfold and unfold until it covered almost all of the countryside as far as the bishop could see. And the bishop finally said, stop, fine, I'll give you your land. And so he gave her land. He also gave her the supplies to build the abbey and horses and water and food for the workers. So
that is awesome. That's the trickster in Brigid. Some of my favorite kinds of stories.
Yes, my other favorite trickster story, and you're going to love this one. It's about the wild fox. And it starts out a very sad story. There was a very poor woodcutter who lived in the woods. And he needed fur and for his family and meat to feed them. And so he found this fox. And he killed the fox and brought the fox home. And his family feasted on the meat. And they turned the pelts into a blanket for the baby. And they thought that that was just a very good day. Well, what they didn't realize was that the fox belonged to the king. And the fox had been very intelligent and tame and used to do tricks for the king and entertain the court, and that was the king's favorite pastime, was making his little fox do tricks for all the people. Well, when the king found out that the fox was dead, he threw the man in prison, and he threatened to have him killed, and he was going to sell off his wife and children as slaves, and they would be sent to the Americas or Australia. And there was nothing the man could do unless he could go out into the woods himself, find another fox, tame it, teach it to do all the exact same tricks, and bring it back to the king. Now, this is an impossible task in itself, made even doubly impossible by the fact that he was locked in a dungeon and there was no way he could even try. So Brigid heard this story and was absolutely infuriated by the injustice. So she jumps in her chariot and she speeds along the countryside as fast as she could to get to the king's castle. As she's going along, a wild fox jumps into the chariot and nestles under her cloak. So they keep going on and on and on until they get to the castle. And Bridget appears before the king, and she says, I'm so sorry that you have lost your pet fox. I cannot understand the kind of grief you must be going through. However, this man didn't mean to hurt you. He did not know that the fox was your pet, and he was in a dire state, and he was just thinking of his family. Could you please forgive him his transgressions and let him and his family go? And the king said, well, I will only do it if you or someone else can bring me a tame fox who can do all the tricks that my previous fox could. And Bridget said, well, I just so happen to have that right here. And she opens her cloak, and out pops the little fox, who sits before the king, looks up at him, and begins to do marvelous tricks. They were even better than the tricks that the first fox had done. And the king was just delighted. And he said, oh, thank you, Bridget. Thank you for bringing me a new fox. I will love and cherish and keep this fox as my pet for all of my days. And yes, the man may go and his wife and children can come home and they can all live happily ever after. And so the people were released and sent back to their cottage. Bridget said farewell to the king and she went along her merry way. And the king was happy. Later that night, the fox escaped, went back to the woods, and he himself lived very, very happy in his den with his mate and his cubs.
Thank you.
And in your research, you also came across some really interesting aspects that connect her to sort of a new world entity known in Haitian Vodou as Maman Brigitte.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
This was one of my favorite pieces in her journey. So just to go over this in case some of your listeners are not aware, during the time when slavery was legal in the West Indies and in the in what is now the United States, Africans were brought over as slaves. Many Irish individuals were traveled to the Caribbean to work as indentured servants. And indentured servants were basically working for free until they could pay off their passage. So it was like you go to the New World and then you work basically as a slave for 20 years or the rest of your life, and then hopefully eventually one of your kids can get free as well. Not nearly as tragic as those who were enslaved and never had the prospect of freedom. It was still a difficult, that's a pretty mild word, it was still a tragic situation for all those who were involved. And when the Irish and the Africans were working alongside together, you had all these people who were in torturous conditions and were away from their indigenous practices. So new religions were built, and many of these influences were shared together. And one of the beings that came into Vodou was Maman Brigitte. Maman Brigitte was said to be the only Loa who had white skin, and she had red hair and, you know, wore very crazy loud costumes and clashing dress. I do not know whether she is meant to be a Caucasian Loa or whether she's meant to embody the face of a bleached skull, because Maman Brigitte was the queen of the cemetery. She married Baron Samedi, and so every time a woman was buried in the cemetery, the first woman buried was sacred to Maman Brigitte. The first man buried was sacred to the Baron. So it's interesting. I don't know which goddess she merged with from the African pantheon, and maybe that's something I would love to find out. But it is interesting that Maman Brigitte was also considered somewhat of a sacred prostitute. And I heard recently that a term for some of the madams that work with modern day prostitutes in Northern Africa, they're often called mamans. So I think that there's probably a very old goddess of sacred prostitution and of beloved ancestors who went to the Caribbean and picked up some aspects of Bridget and said, okay, these are mine now. And I leave that for other people to discover, or maybe I'll get it into my own head that I need to go learn some more, which is highly likely prospect. So this is, I think that this is a way, I think that in a lifestyle where you didn't even own your body, you could only own your soul, the prospect of death was a prospect of hope. And so the idea of Maman Brigitte being there to welcome, guide you, and to celebrate you when you're finally free of a life of torture and enslavement is a really blessed sight indeed. So even if her appearance is much more one of death than, say, in Ireland, where she's much more one of life, to me that hope doesn't change when you put it in that sort of context.
Well, of course, and obviously even the idea of agriculture changes from something that is supporting us to something that we're chained to.
Right.
So that would make, I think, so much sense for a transition like that to happen. So, you know, we've been talking about, you know, the hearth, the home, milk, cheese, and wheat. And you are the high priestess of a coven in the concrete jungle of New York City.
Yeah. That's true.
What is that like? You know, what do you being a person of a notable person in Wicca and paganism in New York City? What have you, you know, what have you seen? How do you translate your experiences of working with ancient agricultural gods to this landscape?
Well, in many ways, I feel like Bridget in New York is an immigrant goddess. So she really embodies the spirits of those who moved to this city, moved to this world from a homeland. So you can imagine an Irish farmer back in the 1800s, early 20th century, who was not able to keep his land, whether he was forced out by famine or by poverty or by, you know, by terror, by domestic terrorism, and he had to go, or she had to go. And they pick up their roots, and they move to New York City, and suddenly they're no longer going to be a farmer. They're no longer going to be a person who works the fields. There's going to be somebody who works in the factory. The spirit is still the same. And I think that one of Bridget's greatest aspects is not just the agriculture, not just the cheese, which is certainly not to denigrate that, because we still don't exist without agriculture. We rely on our farmers. We rely on having healthy food. But I think one of the things that is so important to her about her is that she is a goddess of revolutionary technology that changes the world. One of her images is her being the goddess of smith workers. And to understand what that means, it's really important to understand how important the role of the smith worker is to a culture. There were no Celts before there was iron working. I mean, there were the people of that region, but what turned this collection of, you know, of very, very different tribes, all kind of living in different, in over one scattered area, but really turned them into unified culture that made them both respected and feared by other people in the world, was that they were able to cultivate iron. So it's more, when you see the goddess pounding on the anvil, she's not just forming a horseshoe. She's not just making nails, although she might be, and those things are important, but what she's doing is she's changing the way people live. So in New York City, I feel like Bridget comes through as the goddess that's going to get us off of fossil fuels, that she is putting innovative technology into our cities to make it, to allow us to be better connected to this planet that we live on. And there are ways that can happen, and I see the way that many of us in this community are composting and working to stop fossil fuel infrastructure and trying to find new ways to impart the technology that will keep us sustained and keep us in health and healthy balance with this planet.
That brings up, you know, your recent activism work, sort of galvanizing, especially the New York pagan, the New York pagans against fracking.
Yeah, that's been fun. So, I hope that listeners know that Governor Cuomo banned fracking in New York State just a couple of months ago, which is a tremendously important initiative. For those who are not familiar, fracking is short for hydraulic fracturing, which is a method of extracting natural gas from shale rock far beneath the earth, and bringing it up to pump into our homes so that we can use it for fuel, but a lot of it is being shipped overseas, and that's the problems with fracking is that it's incredibly polluting to the water. It's incredibly polluting to the air, and it really devastates the communities that it goes into. It's not the kind of job creator that it's often touted to be. It tends to create very few jobs, and usually for people that are imported workers. When I visited a fracking site in Pennsylvania, all the workers are driving cars from Oklahoma, and the community was not full of gas tycoons as I expected. It was a lot of shuttered businesses, a lot of dilapidated homes, and a lot of people who were very, very sick from being exposed to this kind of chemical chemicals that are in the water. So as a, you know, that was one of the things that I needed to work on when I finished my book. One, because Bridget is a goddess of innovative technology, there was a call to me to help work on getting us off of these antiquated systems that are making us sick and are not helping our lives. But also, I think about my own carbon footprint when I'm publishing a book, because that's going on paper. Even if it's recycled paper, it is still the process, the carbon that's produced in making the book and shipping the book and people reading it and buying copies for their friends, which is wonderful, and I'm glad, but I also need to, because I'm taking resources in order to put my words into the world, I need to find another way to help the world and, you know, create balance there. And perhaps this was Bridget Led that I said, you know, after I finish my book, I'm going to spend a year working on activist endeavors, especially having to do with the environment. And there seemed to be a lot of pagans that were really in despair in the city about what we're supposed to do about the environment. We got slammed by Hurricane Sandy. We've noticed our summers are getting really, really hot. We've had some very cold winters, but even the fluctuation between, we don't really have the fall and spring that we used to. It moves from this bitter cold winter to a super hot summer. People notice that and they get frightened, but they feel like there's nothing they can do. And I feel that I was able to really lean into the spirit of Bridget of giving people hope for a better future by showing us what we can do, that it's not just about you know, what they call the green blues and thinking, oh, this planet is going to hell and there's nothing we can do to stop it. It's like, well, if we start thinking that way, then yes, that's true. This is a huge, huge problem that we as a human species have never dealt with before. So now is the time to try to make it work. And I think that's where Bridget's spirit is coming through again, is we need another technological revolution that will get us away from the habits of the past and into a future that is safe, sane, and sustainable.
Well, having participated in rituals led by your coven, Novices of the Old Ways, this isn't the first time that you've worked ritually and magically on behalf of an environmental or social justice cause. I remember one of the first Sabbat rituals that I attended with Novices of the Old Ways. There was a lot of the energy of that ritual was geared toward marriage equality in New York.
Yeah, that was one of the crowning moments of my priestess life. And that, and for those that are not familiar, the holiday of Beltane is around the first weekend in May. And on a practical sense, in Northern Europe, people would use the first part of May to basically get pregnant, because babies conceived at the beginning of May would be born in early February. This meant that the women could help finish the harvest, and that when the babies were born, they were born to mothers who had exposure to fresh food. Early February in Northern Europe is when the cows and the sheep start giving milk again. They're able to make cheese, and it's often sometimes pre-technological revolutions that we've had, this was really important that this period of time was often when people had their first fresh food that they had in months. So that's what we talk about May Day and dancing around a maypole, which has very phallic imagery. So, but one of the aspects of Beltane was about marriage, because back in the day, if people wanted to have a baby, they would need to make sure that this person, that whoever they're going to be shacking up with, is going to stick around and help them take care of it. So people would get married around the beginning of May, and so there was a lot of ideas of Beltane being the holiday of marriage. Well, in New York City, or in New York State at the time, not everybody could get married, so why would we have a holiday to celebrate marriage when there were so many people among us who couldn't enjoy that? So it made sense to raise a cone of energy to throw at the New York State Senate and say it's really time to start changing this plan and start letting people have the rights that they deserve. And it was a magical thing. And a few weeks later, marriage equality passed in New York State. Now, naturally, that's not because of us solely. that's because of a dozen years of people pounding on doors and pounding on and begging, you know, legislators to pay attention to this cause. I think that maybe we gave it the energetic push that it needed right at the end, and perhaps we were simply part of that momentum. But that was a really beautiful night that night that we, and sometimes, I mean, in, as a priestess, it can be a rather treacherous territory to bring people into, ritually into a social justice cause. I mean, same-sex marriage was a no-brainer for our community because everybody, it didn't feel political, it felt like a human rights initiative. And even though people made it political in some situations, for within our community, it wasn't political. Environmental work can take on an element of politics as well, is because the, you know, you're in a circle and you're trying to raise energy to ban fracking. Well, it turns out that somebody there's father is a natural gas worker, and so there's a sense of, I didn't sign on for this. I didn't come here to do this. This is my faith, and I want to celebrate my holiday, but I don't want to be told that what my family is doing is wrong. And that's where lines can get really, really blurry. So I've tended to do my political rituals as kind of an offset. Usually many of the same people that are leading them are also people in my coven. But I make it pretty clear that there's a time for more ubiquitous worship, and then there's a time for more focus on the issues at hand energetically. Then again, I have brought speakers to my different rituals and Sabbaths to talk about the dangers of fracking, the dangers of, you know, some of the environmental practices here in the state, because that's information people need to have. And my feeling is we're going to get all these people together in the same room, that we're going to take the opportunity to educate them, or we're going to take the opportunity to do, you know, to do good work together. So hope that makes sense.
Well, the line between the personal and the political is always an interesting line, you know, to have to navigate. But you know, I think that the word education here is really potent when it comes to, you know, no matter where we are, no matter what our families are doing, you know, can we bring in voices to talk about their experiences? I remember your voice reading your blog post and you saying, you know, I went to a fracking site and this is what it smelled like. This is, you know, can we begin to come up with some ideas about what's really happening based on experiences that people are having? And particularly with the ritual that, the Beltane ritual, at which energy was raised toward marriage equality in New York, I remember being amazed because we had, you know, there was drumming, there was ritual possession, and then, you know, we turned around and you were like, oh, by the way, here's this council person that's been here, you know, the whole time, and, you know, they have some things to say and share about, you know, efforts in this direction. And it was just like, wow, this is leadership. You know, this is leadership to be able to bring in people from outside of traditions, from outside of communities, and have them intermingle in this way and participate. And I remember the person was in a suit, and everyone else was in, you know, far more, you know, floral and sort of festive wear.
wearing crowns of horns and stuff like that.
It was such a beautiful moment to me, because it's like, wow, this is what's happening. You know, people can do this. It just takes people like you to reach out and do that kind of work. So kudos and thank you so much.
That was one. You are listening to another fine production of the LMC Radio Network, whose art and information may be found on its webcast shows. The LMC Radio Network is a community radio alliance of metaphysical, spiritual, inspirational, and political justice broadcasters, spanning a wide range of topics. Tune in Sundays for the Lucky Mojo Hoodoo Rootwork Hour, hosted by Catherine Ironwood and Conjurman Ollie. It features panel discussions on traditional African-American hoodoo spellcasting with members of the Association of Independent Readers and Rootworkers, plus free readings and magical rootwork advice for live call-in clients. This is the longest-running conjure show on the planet and may be heard from 3 o'clock to 4:30 Pacific Time Sunday afternoons. On Mondays, get ready for Candelo's Corner. Starring Candelo Cambisa and Malik Cambisa, this is the voice of authentic Cuban Palo and Dominican Sanse in the United States, with special guests representing the entire range of African traditional and diasporic religions. You can hear Candelo's Corner Monday evenings from 5 to 7 Pacific Time. On Tuesdays, a pair of outstanding hosts point the way to essential values. First, on the Crystal Silence League Hour, John St. Germain provides spiritual guidance in the practical use of crystals and crystal balls for the development of mental concentration, mind power, divination, and telepathic communication. His show airs Tuesday evenings from 5 to 6 o'clock Pacific Time. Once you have your bearings, engage in activism and social justice in the streets with Beverly Smith. Beverly brings listeners front-page reports on the ongoing struggle for racial, gender, and social justice, shedding much light on civil and social rights issues. Her cry for freedom begins at 6 p.m. Pacific Time and inspires us for 1 hour. On Wednesdays, Andrea Weston's Liquid Libations pour forth to bless us with poetry, short stories, and spoken word performances. If you are a poet or someone who simply enjoys the beauty and power of words, then Liquid Libations welcomes your participation. Call in and read your work. Listen for Liquid Libations on Wednesdays from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Pacific Time. On Thursdays, from deep in the heart of Texas, it's the Now You Know Show with Professor Porterfield. In a variety show laced with country wit and biblical wisdom, the silver-tongued professor shares his knowledge of roots and delivers the lucky numbers. From 6 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Time, there's no end to the surprises. All shows on the LMC Radio Network are sponsored by the Lucky Mojo Curio Company, located in Forestville, California, and online at luckymojo.com. Add 3 hours for Eastern. Tax and license may apply. Train departure times and Burma shave signs subject to change without notice. LMC.
Lucky Mojo Curio Company is based in sunny Forestville, California, and provides traditional spiritual products for remediating all kinds of conditions. Locate them online at luckymojo.com or visit them in person to see the world's smallest church, Missionary Independent Spiritual.
I'd love to get, for our listeners here, a bit of an understanding of Novices of the Old Ways, which is a coven that is grounded in progressive Wicca. Can you talk a bit about what progressive Wicca is?
Well, I mean, we've been calling it more progressive witchcraft over the last few years than Wicca, and I think it's just because more of our people identify as witches more than Wiccans. And for those who are listening, you know, witchcraft exists in all cultures and all religions, and it's working with the spirits of the fringe, I think is the way to say it. And where the mainstream faith can't quite go, the witches can meet you there to really get into the underbelly of the divine and change the world into one that we wish to see. And Wicca is one form of that. Wicca is its own religion based on witchcraft practices. And but I think that one of the things where we're a little different than Wicca is that Wicca has a very Eurocentric viewpoint, and that's because it came from England. So it's kind of natural that it is. And so I think, though, being witches, we really want to try to connect with the spirits and the people of the region that we live in, which is New York City. And so it's not a religion set up for people living in the countryside of England. isn't necessarily going to work for the people that live in New York City. Many occult faiths, I feel, could be a little stronger if they focus less on finding the people to be part of the tradition and more about building the tradition to suit the people who are present. And that is one of the big objectives of Novices in the Old Ways, is that to build pagan ritual and educate people on the practice of witchcraft with that connects them to the environment that they live in. So finding the divine feminine, the divine masculine, the divine both or neither, basically the divine of this planet within the concrete jungle, and to create safe, sacred space for like-minded individuals. We revel in what I call the sacred otherness. We don't like to other people. When I say quote-unquote other people, we like to bring in those who have been othered by larger groups. And we build our rituals to based around what we feel is happening with our city at the time. And at our past Immolc, which was in February, we focused on the idea of the sacred warrior and brought in Bridget, since that was her holiday, but also bringing her in as the spirit of the well, the spirit of the forge, and also the spirit of the divine warrior. So those that the individuals present could gain the magic to fight the battles in their lives, whatever those battles may be. And once we can empower the individuals in the space to fight their battles, and they are then empowered to go fight the battles that plague their communities. And one thing that we also do is we try not to cling too hard to standard or more common gender roles. Like at our last ritual, we had a man stand as Bridget at one point, and we didn't dress him as female. He didn't present as female. He was just, he was a man with a female spirit. And to show that the spirit of Bridget does not need to just be in someone who has a female body, that she seeks any willing vessel. And that's where I think that people in a lot of, mainstream religions, even some occult faiths, forget that the divine is genderless. And the divine mixes, changes its mind quite a bit about how it identifies as gender. And we, within Novices in the Old Ways, have been really working to explore that and see what that means for our rituals and our community.
Yeah, gender is absolutely, I was looking at some of the workshops that a colleague of mine is teaching at the upcoming Pagan Spirit Gathering. Gender is really a hot topic, not just in mainstream America, but definitely in paganism and various circles of witchcraft. Looking back at how the gender was seen in, say, traditional Gardnerian Wiccan practices in the 1950s, and today, and how groups that have branched out of that idea and are carrying forward either similar conversations regarding gender mysteries or new conversations. I think it comes back to what you just said, building traditions around the people who are present, and the people, making those things relevant. Speaking of relevancy, what is relevant to you right now? What upcoming projects or goals are you aiming toward? What's happening?
Well, I've got a lot of, I'm hitting the road a lot these days to promote Bridget. I'm actually going to Atlanta in a little over a week, a twofold trip. One, I'm going with my job to an interfaith conference focusing on racial equality in Atlanta with about 90 other faith leaders. And there will be a couple of faces there from the pagan community, which I'm very excited about. And while I'm down there, though, I'll be lecturing 3 different times on the book and meeting some other Bridgetites, which I'm very excited about. And I'm also teaching in North Carolina and Delaware, Portland, Oregon, and New Jersey over the next few months. I also am working on a second book, which will be coming out, released by Wiser, in the fall of 2016. and it's called Tarot for One, and it focuses on teaching people how to read tarot for themselves, which can be a very difficult task for many of us. Even seasoned readers who do well reading for other people can struggle reading for themselves. So the book is more like a tool book to help people figure out the patterns in their tarot cards that can help them be very specific about their own personal readings.
Well, that's awesome, and this isn't your first foray into the world of tarot, as you are also the creator of the Tarot of the Burrows.
Yes, that's about 5 years ago. I released a deck with my friend George Courtney. No, his name is that. We're not intending to have the same name. And he and did a. That was a big question people had. Is that an artistic choice? We're like, no, it's just his surname is Courtney. That's my first name. And it is a contemporary tarot deck composed entirely of photography with images of New York City. So it's not just walking around taking pictures of the landscape. It's actually capturing the people of the city as they can be reflected in the tarot. So that was a labor of love for me a number of years ago. And it still remains to be pretty popular to this day. So it's... that's exciting, too.
It's truly a beautiful deck. Where can people order it?
Well, I'm working on getting getting space people to order it online. Right now, you can find me through my website, which is thecocowitch.com, thecocowitch. There is a tab for Tarot of the Burrows. Y'all bear with me. I'm trying to get it up and going, but you can email me at the moment if you're interested in a copy, and I can get one to you that way. Hopefully soon I'll have a better ordering system up in place for that.
And are there any open circles or open rituals or any events that are coming up either that you're leading or that you're leading with your coven that folks should know about?
Well, yes. One of my students, Wendy, who is a priestess in training, will be leading our summer solstice ritual in June here in New York. If you're interested, we're a very social media heavy group. I was just getting on Facebook and adding yourself to the Novices of the Old Ways page where you can find the information that we're doing that there. We don't have a website at the moment. We hopefully will soon. It's a Mercury retrograde. I'm listing all the technological things that are broken in my world right now. Part of my website and my coven's website. But we're also, you can find us on Witchvox. We post our events there as well. So we'll also have a Lunasa ritual, which is the first weekend in August, probably in Central Park. And these are open to the public. If you are under 18, you must bring a guardian with you. But other than that, please show up. Have a good time.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing that. I know that people are interested and excited about engaging with community, especially here in New York City, which is such a gigantic place, but can be a really lonely place as well.
Yeah.
So I'm so grateful for the work that you do. I know that your rituals have connected me to really, really beautiful, powerful people in the tri-state area. And I know that you will continue to do that work. Thank you so much for being such a wonderful guest, bringing such powerful messages regarding environmentalism and warriorship and leadership to the stage here.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm really honored to have been on your show.
Well, you know, we'll be doing sushi, you know, uptown definitely before the next couple of months are out. Listeners, this has been Courtney Weber, our featured guest this episode, author of Brigid, History, Mystery, and Magic of the Celtic Goddess, whom we are so grateful to have here. And thank you so much for tuning in, as this has been another episode of On Sacred Ground with your host, Kai Armand. Tune in next week as we continue to go deep into the heart of the human experience in which place plays a primary role. Until then, keep a light in your window for courage in our times. I'll be keeping a light in mine. Thank you again, Courtney.
Thank you, Kai.
are.